Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I was asked to discuss the distinction between the natural and the artificial. Now, we've all seen this definition probably a dozen times by now. Hopefully you have it all memorized. Nature is an internal principle and cause of being moved and being at rest, and that to which it belongs primarily in virtue of itself and not accidentally, right? Each specific kind of natural body is associated with the characteristic movement or activity, and such a body will immediately and necessarily engage in its natural motion if nothing external prevents it from doing so. Now, this notion of nature comes up in the physics. The physics is the study of change, both change itself and the things that do so. And this marks the main division. There are those things that have natures, these internal principles of movement and rest, simple bodies, mixtures, living organisms that might not be exhaustive. There may be other things, but these are clear cases of things that have natures. And artifacts, presumably, those things that do not have an internal principle of movement and rest, their principle of movement and rest is external. This is excluding things that come to be by chance and accidental compounds. But now, both Aristotle and Aquinas are committed to some version of what is commonly called the nature-craft analogy. This allows a limited extension of insights about the voluntary actions of a master artificer performs to the natural movements involved in the generation of living organisms. So here's Aquinas. He says, as the philosopher teaches in Book 2 of the Physics, art imitates nature. The reason for this is that operations and effects stand proportionately in the same relation to one another as their principles among themselves. Now, the principle of those things that come about through art is the human intellect, and the human intellect derives according to a certain resemblance from the divine intellect, which is the principle of natural things. Hence, the operations of art must imitate the operations of nature, and the things that exist through art must imitate the things that are in nature. Now, I don't know if this strikes you as odd or peculiar for a fundamental distinction in a science to yield classes of objects that have enough in common that it would justify parallel explanations across the division, right? You're marking a fundamental division between the natural and the artificial, but they're gonna be common enough that you can actually say quite a few things are similar between them. What I want to do today, though, is I wanna talk about what the natural and the artificial have in common, how despite these commonalities, they nevertheless differ in fundamental ways, and also how the natural and the artificial can interact and overlap in significant, and to me at least, surprising ways. Now, rather than dump a lot of theory out, I'm gonna proceed by just examining cases, and the account will come forth bit by bit as we go through them. There are what I call the easy cases. I don't know how easy they are. Simple bodies like fire, a house will be my example of an artifact, living organisms, Bengal tiger. They're easy cases, they're gonna be hard cases too. I'm going to talk about bread, olives. You'd be surprised how complicated olives are. cities and human beings, especially in heaven. All right. So first, simple bodies. We'll take fire as our main example. One interesting thing about simple bodies and inanimate natural bodies is that they are uniform. They don't have parts. So you're looking, you know, your scientist looking at a big chunk of earth. It's just earth throughout, right? Get out your magnifying glass, looks exactly the same. Get out your microscope, it's exactly the same. At any level of magnification, it's just filled with uniform stuff, earth or fire or air or water. Nevertheless, the activity is fairly complex that these uniform bodies engage in. So there are four simple terrestrial bodies, earth, water, air, fire. And though they are simple qua bodies, they are, you know, they're the simplest material components from which all other bodies come to be. Each can be analyzed into three elements, one from each of three pairs of contraries. We've got the hot and the cold, the wet and the dry, the heavy and the light. Fire, which we're going to talk about, is hot, dry, and light plus, maximally light. These elements are associated with capacities for movement, right? The thermal and hygric elements are interactive capacities. They're capacities to move and be moved by other bodies in which they are in contact. The ponderal elements are non-interactive capacities. They are principles of locomotion. Each is a capacity of a natural body to move by nature to its own place. So if nothing prevents it from doing so, a parcel of fire, being maximally light, will move without force from its current location to its natural place at the periphery of the sublunar sphere, and upon reaching its natural place, it will rest there without force. Fire's lightness is not a capacity to move in a particular direction. Some people say it's up, right? But it's a capacity to move to and rest at, strictly speaking, a capacity to be at a determinate location. Yeah. Now, everything that occurs by nature occurs for the sake of some end. More precisely, it's natures themselves that, I'm going to talk about Aristotle and Aquinas interchangeably. I know that's probably bad in some ways, but at least on this topic, I'll note when it differs. Sometimes you'll get Aristotle quotes, sometimes you'll get Aquinas quotes. You can yell at me if in doing so I've messed something up significantly. So Aristotle says that natures themselves are for the sake of an end. Now, a natural body's formal and final causes are one, because the essence of a thing, the form for this, is the end, or that for the sake of which. So a nature is directed toward an end, its form, but this form is something's nature. The form indeed is nature more than, perhaps rather than, the matter. Consequently, a nature is directed in a way towards itself. As Aristotle says, a nature is a road towards nature. So natural movement is, in a way, a kind of formal perfection. It's a movement that constitutes the further realization or perpetuation of something as the kind of being it is. Nature is the beginning of a change only if it is the change's end. That is, only if the change, when nothing interferes with it, results in that for the sake of which change occurs, namely the further realization or perpetuation of the nature, the form itself. He says this progression is a development of the thing into itself and its fulfillment. It's developing a quality already possessed, being fire. Now, a natural body's end is a good relative to the kind of body it is. So when a parcel of fire, say, moves to its proper location, it's not only exercising a capacity to be at a location, for the movement of each body to its own place is movement toward its own form. It's attaining or more fully realizing the good for the sake of which its motion occurs, where this good simply is its form. So fire is complete and lacking in nothing when it occupies its proper place, because for it to be at this place is for it to achieve its natural end and good. Fire, you know, you got fire at the center and you got fire at the periphery. They are both fire, but the latter is fire in actuality in the fullest sense. So moves there, it's much happier. When it rests in its proper place, fire's actively realizing its form in the most complete way that it can. It's good for fire itself to move to the periphery, and it's best for fire to arrive there and rest. That's when fire's really, really most fire. Now, this is going to be very different from artifacts. We'll start with houses. So you start off here in the case, I'm thinking of a brick house. You got a pile of bricks. That is the house in potentiality. I mean, not just any matter will do. It has to be materially adequate. There's reasons why carpenters don't start, you know, they don't go to Bed Bath & Beyond to get a bunch of pillows or some Ziploc bags full of water. Bricks have the tangible capacities needed to be built into a house. They also have to be situationally adequate, right? Like let's say it takes 1,000 bricks to build a house. It's probably more. I mean, there could be 1,000 brick factories, and you could pick the first brick off the assembly line on a given day and think of that collection. That's not a house in potentiality. It's not situated correctly. In order to be a house in potentiality, it has to be ready and poised for the craftsperson to work on it so that the only thing needed for it to change from a house in potentiality to a house in actuality is this guy coming in and exercising his capacity to build a house, right? Now, the house builder, they've got the form of a particular house in mind, and they use their knowledge of the art of house building. This is how you learn how to build a house. It's actually probably not book learning. You got to be an apprentice or something, but it's hard to, ChatGPT can't come up with apprenticeship in a good picture. they use the knowledge that constitutes the art of house building to determine the best means to bring about that form in the appropriate manner. And it's successful, you got a house. Look at how happy he is. He's done his job. Now, the logic that governs the production of a house, it's peculiar. It consists in explanations that employ what is commonly called hypothetical necessitation. The hypothesis in question is the coming to be of a specific kind of being. And you need to know what must also come to be in order for the hypothesized being to exist. Here's a schema that describes how these explanations go. This has a lot of variables and is awful to look at. So it's better to just go through an example, in this case with the house. So you say, all right, a house, here's the hypothesis, a house has come to be. And so you start, well, what is a house? What are some of the things that a house must have, some essential things? So number one, providing shelter from precipitation. I mean, houses do lots of things. This is one of the things they do. That's an essential activity of something with the form of a house. So if a house is to come to be, what else must come to be for that to happen? Well, it's got to have some part, the roof, that has the function of providing shelter from precipitation. And in order for it to do that, it's got to have certain characteristics. It's got to be durable. It's got to be waterproof, probably some other things as well. And so you look around and you say, well, what things have those characteristics? Solid bodies, wood, in particular, earthen ones. So the roof is realized in an earthen material. At least in time of Athens, when Aristotle was writing, it would be fired clay tiles. What's interesting about this, within this framework, both the determination of a part's function and thereby its identity, right? What is it to be a roof is to do what roofs do, right? The determination of this function and the determination of the part's material capacities depend on the role the part's coming to be serves in the coming to be of the artifact to which it belongs, considered as a whole. Right. Now, one feature of this, well, you move all these bricks around, and the resulting house, it's going to persist as a house only so long as the plurality of bricks continues to exercise its relevant tangible capacities, right? A house builder moves bricks in numerous ways, but none of these changes prevent the bricks in a finished house from being bricks in exactly the same manner they exhibited before the process began. And you could point, like you could track the brick. Here it was in the pile, here it is in the house. They're still bricks. Nothing's changed about the bricks, just how they're organized, right? So it's the matter from which a house comes to be, a plurality of bricks, that is the house in actuality. Before their capacities, of materially and situationally adequate bricks are exercised, they are, in one manner of being, already a house. They're a house in potentiality, right? The same bricks, when made to continuously exercise these capacities by a house builder, they remain a house, but are such in a distinct and more complete manner, their house in actuality. And it's the continuous exercise of these bricks' capacities, the very passive capacities whose initial exercise occasions the house's coming to be, in which the persistence of the house in actuality consists. But this leads to a very interesting feature about the matter of artifacts and houses, what I call the contingent specification of matter. Right? This is the most generalized form. We'll see, it doesn't apply this generally, but it does apply to artifacts like houses, right? So for a hylomorphic composite with a given form, it must contain some matter that's actually present, that's there, that's identifiable independently of its having that form, and is capable of being so formed. This applies pretty readily to the bricks. Matter's contingent specification, it's clear in the artifactual examples Aristotle employs when he even introduces hylomorphism, right? The philosophy 101 example, right? You've got the same bronze present during and after it has the form of a statue, right? That is, the same bronze persists as such through the statue's generation and destruction. And though a given parcel of bronze has the capacity to take on the form of a particular statue, its identity as bronze bears no necessary relationship to the form it acquires and loses. Now, one consequence of this is that, at least from the point of view of the student of nature, looking at what things have natures, houses are going to be in some way natural heaps. There are lots of natures. Each brick still is earthen and has their own proprietary internal principle of movement and rest. It's several natures plus an external principle of generation, an external imposition of form on something that already had its own identity and its own nature. Here's Aquinas, he says, all artificial forms are accidental forms, for art operates only upon that which is already constituted in complete being by nature. The second quote here, a man and wood and a stone are natural bodies, a house and an axe are artificial. Natural bodies, however, appear to be substances more than artificial bodies, since natural bodies are the principles of artificial bodies. For art operates upon material which nature provides, and a form which is introduced through art is an accidental form, such as a shape or something of that sort. For this reason, artificial bodies are not in the genus of substance in virtue of their form, but only in virtue of their matter, which is natural. Maybe not even a substance then, because like in the case of a house, it wouldn't be one underlying nature, but a heap of different ones, right? There are a lot of different substances there. So a house builder plying his trade will move bricks in numerous ways, but none of these movements prevent the bricks in a finished house from being bricks in exactly the same manner they exhibited before the building began. They're each earthen rectangular prisms and have their own autonomous internal principles of movement and rest. This is why in discussing a different example, both Aristotle and Aquinas agree that if anything comes to be from a bed buried in wood, it will be wood via sprouts issuing from its planks and not another bed. I don't think you could do this now since most beds are just made out of particle board dipped in formaldehyde. I doubt anything would grow if I put a bed underground. But you know, this is when, you know, the olden days when you might still have some general principle in the wood still present that would sprout. Right. So consequently, you know, a house may still occupy the category substance within like a subject predicate sentence. It's not a substance in its strongest sense. It's a plurality of externally related substances. That is not to say that artifacts fail to realize any kind of unity over and above the unities of the natural bodies they comprise. I mean, you can accept that an artifact is a totality of this something, right? Which is one of the hallmarks of a substance. This is because a house does possess what I would call an artifactual unity. And the artifactual unity depends on the house being the realization through techne of a form present in the mind of the craftsman, the artificer. The artificer takes natural bodies and moves them in ways contrary to their natures so as to create an object that instantiates a predetermined form. But this artifactual form does not grant the artifact any internal unity. That is, an artifact does not possess a single overarching internal principle of movement and rest. Strictly speaking, being a house is a way for bricks to be, as far as nature is concerned. A house is not one, but many. All right. Third, quote unquote, easy case. I don't think any of these are easy, but this is a comparative claim, right? Living organisms, here's one of them, right? Bengal tiger. As I said, there is what I was calling the nature-craft analogy. There are going to be some things about, in this case, living organisms, that are going to track exactly how one would want to explain the coming to be of artifacts. And one of these is that kind of schema of hypothetical necessitation, explanations of a living organism's parts, their functions, and their material constitutions. So we can have basically the same kind of explanation we gave for houses that we do for tigers. All right, what is a tiger? What's essential to a tiger life? Many things, but one of them is being capable of seeing, right? Seeing is an activity essential to a Bengal tiger life. So, right, hypothesis, Bengal tigers come to be. What else must be the case in order for that to happen? Well, if it's essential that they are seeing beings, it must have an organ. We'll call it the eye. That is for the sake of seeing. And in order for an eye to see, it must be transparent. I mean, how else are those sensible species gonna get into your soul? They're gonna bounce off if it's not. Fluid bodies are transparent, watery ones, so the eye is realized in a watery material. these explanations can keep going, right? If you've got something fluid, you're going to need something to protect it. That's going to be earthen. You get eyelids and their material. Go into the parts of animals, you'll see these explanations go incredibly deep, like seven layers. So an organ's natural function is a capacity whose existence is explained by the role the organ plays in an organism's generation and persistence. If an organ is to come to be with its essential or hypothetically necessary natural function, it must have an appropriate material constitution as well. So the coming to be of an individual that instantiates a specific form of life hypothetically necessitates the coming to be of organs with form-determined natural functions. And the coming to be of an organ with a form-determined natural function hypothetically necessitates that it be realized in tissues that possess a form-determined set of material capacities. Now, you might think, all right, well, things are so common now between natural and the artificial, why wouldn't the rest of the things we said about houses also apply to living organisms? For example, why wouldn't the matter of an organism be contingently specifiable as well? I mean, an organism's tissues, they seem to be materially indistinguishable from inanimate bodies with identical elemental compositions. They've got a specific temperature on the hot-cold spectrum, a specific level of moisture on the wet-dry, a specific amount of heaviness on the heavy-light spectrum. One odd thing is that, if this were correct, the unfettered exercise of these material capacities would cause a lot of chaos. It would disrupt the organization required for the organism's vital activities. So for example, if left to their own devices, our predominantly earthen bone would move to a location that's close to the cosmos's center, and our comparatively fiery flesh would move toward a higher location. So how does an organism maintain its bodily unity and vital organization in the face of these natural tendencies? Here's one suggestion that you'll even see in Aristotle. He asks this, he's talking about plants. He says, all right, what is it that holds tissues that possess the material capacities of fire and earth together, given that they tend to move in opposite directions? For they'll be torn apart if there's nothing to restrict them. And his answer, important, but if there's something, it will be the soul, the cause of growth and nourishment. I call this the prison model, because on this model, the soul's playing the role of warden, trying to just keep all of these unruly natural bodies from doing what they'd want to do on their own, which would kind of look like what happens down below, which, again, would not be good for our continuing to live. Now, extending this analysis from artifacts to living organisms is going to have some obstacles. The obvious candidates for living organisms matter, right? The body, the organs, even the tissues are identified by their functions. It is organisms matter is its natural instrumental body. And to be an organ or a tissue is, to belong to an organic body, an instrumental body, is to possess the capacities necessary to perform a characteristic ergon, a work or job or function. What a thing is always determined by its function, right? This applies not just to the larger organs like eyes, but to tissues as well. So for an organic body to exist, it must actually have the capacities required to work in a particular way. But the capacities that a body must possess in order to exercise its identity-determining function, they're the very same capacities whose possession entails that a body is ensouled, right? We can correctly say that a thing lives if it possesses all the capacities that enable it to function in one or more of the basic ways life manifests itself. So if this is correct, a living organism's matter, unlike an artifact's matter, is essentially not contingently informed. And this is reflected in attributions of what Aristotle calls homonymy, right? Homonyms, things are homonyms if they differ in their account, in their essence or account, but are nevertheless picked out by a single word. A bank is both the side of a river and a financial institution, right? And Aristotle's explicit in Aquinas as well that the living body and its parts are not identical to anything that is present in a body bereft of soul. For example, though we would apply a single word, heart, to both the organ currently pumping in our chest and the visually indistinguishable object before us on the autopsy table. The latter is called a heart merely homonymously, in name only. It's a heart name only. It stands to a pumping embodied heart as a sharp knife stands to a sharp note, or as a man stands to a picture of a man. So how are we supposed to then view the matter of living organisms, right? I mean, living organisms are paradigmatic natural substance. What comes to be by nature is a man or a plant or some other of these things, Aristotle says, which we say are substances most of all. And as such, living organisms are unities and individuals par excellence. But Aquinas, Aristotle as well, they are clear that no substance is composed of substances that are also present in it in actuality. It is impossible that a substance should be composed of many substances actually present in it, for two actual things are never one actual thing. So, how can this be? How are we to understand the substantial unity of living organisms then? I suggest that what we could do is appeal to their status as natural. They are unities in the same way, in many of the same ways that even the simple bodies and mixtures are. Yeah. So we've already seen the soul is a living organism's form, and this form is a nature. The soul, qua nature, is the formal cause and the unifying principle of both the vital activity that is the manifestation of a living organism being what it is, and of the living body through which it realizes this essential vital activity. The soul is also the end for the sake of which an organism's vital capacities come to be, and the end of the vital movements and activities that occur when these capacities are exercised. So all of an organism's vital movements occur for the sake of an organism's form. Living organisms, like all natural bodies, move for the sake of their own formal completion. To move or act by nature is to further realize or perpetuate oneself. To achieve one's natural end is to be complete and lacking in nothing as the kind of thing one is. And to achieve one's natural end is to achieve one's specific good. And it follows that all the numerous vital movements we can distinguish in an organism, like there's all sorts of things going on, not just my seeing and walking and speaking, but all the heatings and coolings and concoctings going on within me at any moment, right? All of these vital movements are ultimately a unity, right? The end for the sake of which all of an organism's many parts come to be is a certain complete action. Each of the bodily movements that occur in or through an organism's parts is an aspect or partial manifestation of a single, unfolding, natural, end-directed activity. So, for example, when I perceive, I'm not just taking on perceptible forms without matter. I'm also partially realizing the form for the sake of which my materially realized capacity to perceive comes to be and is in the first place. To perceive is to realize more completely the kind of being one is, qua perceiver. So each of an organism's vital movements belong to the single specific activity of living in which an organism's substantial being consists. I mean, at the most basic level, an organism does one thing. It lives. I do one thing. I live a human life. That Bengal tiger is living a Bengal tiger life. That's the single natural activity under which all of the other vital movements are a partial manifestation. So a living organism body is continuous by nature. The vital movements we distinguish in an organism are a unity. Each of these movements is an aspect or partial manifestation of this single natural end-directed activity. And an organism's natural movement is the exercise of a unitary capacity to engage in that specific activity of living in which its substantial being consists. In this way, as Aquinas says, there is no other substantial form in man besides the intellectual soul, say the human soul, which is an intellectual soul. That's the one soul we have. And that the soul itself alone does whatever the imperfect forms do in other things, right? Like the heatings that go on in the tissues, you might think they're the same kind of heatings that go on in an inanimate body, but that's not true. In the inanimate body, they would have their own internal principle of movement and rest. In a living organism, there's only one internal principle of movement and rest, one nature, which is the soul, and that's the principle of even the tissues, heatings and coolings and things that we might think are indistinguishable from the inanimate ones. That's good. I'm a little over halfway through, and now it's time for the hard cases. Bread. When I first worked this stuff out, I was working on Aristotle, and my example was cakes. Aquinas cares about bread more, for perhaps obvious reasons. All right. I want to focus on a quite simple creation, right? A uniform body in the shape of, say, a rectangular prism, square prism, call it a loaf, right? That comes to be from a few simple ingredients, themselves uniform through a baker's artistic activity. Now, there are several respects in which bread resembles naturally arising mixtures more than they resemble non-uniform artifacts like houses. Yeah. So you've got a collection of ingredients. To be a loaf of bread, they must satisfy appropriate conditions of material and situational adequacy, right? That is, the ingredients must possess a determinate ratio of the proper tangible capacities. Moreover, the movements a baker initiates facilitate changes that are, if we prescind from the baker's influence, entirely natural. Once the ingredients are moved through artifice into a condition and arrangement conducive to mixing, the mixing that occurs is no different qua mixing than what would transpire if the ingredients arrived in that condition and arrangement through the natural exercises of their own locomotive capacities. Aristotle states explicitly that the process of concoction is the same in an artifactual and a natural instrument, but the cause will be the same in every case. I don't know what would have to happen for, you know, your flour and your water to accidentally splash on each other and then someone accidentally shakes the table and they mix. Like, I mean, there are ways, but like once they're in the right condition, it doesn't matter who put them into that condition. The mixing is going to be exactly the same. Second, the result of baking, right? What comes out, the loaf of bread, qua uniform body, is materially indistinguishable from what would result if those same ingredients were mixed naturally. A loaf of bread is not just a natural unity, right? It's also an artifact. But bread, like inanimate mixtures, is a natural unity nonetheless. The matter from which bread comes to be, unlike the matter from which a house comes to be, does not persist in the bread in the same manner of being it exists before the baking begins, right? The bread's ingredients before they're mixed are the uniform bodies they are in actuality. After the ingredients are mixed, they are those uniform bodies merely in potentiality. They exist virtually in the Thomistic lingo. But they aren't just natural bodies. Like a loaf of bread isn't just a natural unity. In contrast to natural bodies, the actual principle of the movements whereby bread comes to be, like the principle of a house builder's movements vis-a-vis bricks, is external to the ingredients that are a loaf of bread in potentiality. Right? A baker moves their ingredients in directions that are contrary to the ingredients' natural motions in order to put them in contact with one another. He then beats the ingredients, which divides them into numerous small, evenly dispersed quantities. Finally, the baker introduces a source of heat to this aggregate of minute juxtaposed ingredients. The external source of heat initiates what they call type of concoction. Oddly, the type of concoction they call it is roasting in translation. I'm not really sure why that's what would happen in baking, but which derives the mixing, that drives the mixing of the aggregate ingredients, and it results ultimately in a uniform natural body. The baker exercises these artistic movements in the order and manner prescribed by the body of knowledge that constitutes the art of baking, and has as an explicit end of his activity the generation of a loaf of bread that instantiates an appropriate form. Right? So in this way, an external artifactual principle can result in what is, from the student of nature's point of view, a uniform body with a single unitary nature. Right? That's an internal principle of all of its tangible movements. This is fine. Like when you have this distinction, you say, oh, they're natural bodies and they're artifacts. You think something couldn't be both. But it's perfectly fine for one and the same thing to both be a natural unity and an artifact. This is a case, and Aquinas agrees. He says, nothing hinders art from making something whose form is not an accident, but a substantial form, just as frogs and serpents can be produced by art. You've got to make Exodus make sense. For art does not produce such a form by its own proper power, but by the power of natural principles. And it is in this way that art produces the substantial form of bread, by the power of fire baking the matter made up of flour and water. Substantial form of bread being bread insofar as it's just a natural inanimate body, the uniform body with the single internal principle of movement and rest. This is long. I guess I'll read it. Although art is not able to introduce a substantial form just by itself, it nevertheless is able to introduce a substantial form by the power of nature, which it uses as an instrument in its own operation. This is shown in the fact that by means of fire, art converts water into vapor and air into fire. And similarly, when an animal is killed and its soul withdraws, another substantial form takes its place. For the generation of one thing is the destruction of another. And in this way, through the mixture of flour and water and the burning of fire, there can follow a substantial form, which is a substantial form by which bread is bread. That less is ambiguous. Like, bread is bread insofar as bread is a uniform natural mixture with its own internal principle of movement and rest. There's another sense in which bread is bread where it's an artifact, right? Like, there is a reality introduced by being a product of artifice that goes over and above its natural identity as just something like that. All right. So a loaf of bread can be, at one and the same time, a natural unity and an artifact. I mean, this is already the case in, like, the initial example, the bronze statue, right? It's both a lump of bronze. It acts exactly like a lump of bronze would if it weren't in the shape of a statue, right? If you push it off a table, it's going to fall down, right, just as any other bronze would do, but it also has the form, the artifactual form of a statue. There are other cases, however, in where something's status as natural and artificial aren't just co-present in this way. There are cases in which art significantly interacts with the artifact's underlying nature. This has to do with the general claim that in many cases, art can complete nature. It says, for generally, art in some cases completes what nature cannot bring to completion. In others, it imitates nature. This is seen most really in crafts like agriculture, we'll get to soon. This is from the Protrepticus. So it says, that which comes into being according to nature does so for a purpose, and its constitution is always superior to that of the products of art. For nature does not imitate art, but art nature, and art exists to aid nature and fill up what nature leaves undone. For some things, nature seems able to complete by itself without assistance, but others with difficulty, or cannot do it all. An example close to hand is what happens when something comes into being. Some seeds obviously generate without protection, whatever ground they fall into, but others need the art of farming as well. An example often discussed in this case was olives. The picture on the left is what olives look like in the wild. They do not look like what you get in the grocery store. There's a way, Aristotle would say, in which through our agricultural practices, we have made olives better, right? We have completed them in a way that they couldn't on their own. The thing on the right is actually what, by nature, olives aspire to be. There are probably even better examples. Does anyone know what this is a picture of? This is what it looks like now, right? Look at how we perfected this thing's nature on its own. It's just this straggly thing. This does raise a question, which I can get into later, about a natural body's proper environment, right? Like, a lot of times you say, like, oh, something's nature is manifested in its proper environment. It's kind of strange that the proper environment in which olives are always located isn't sufficient to actually bring about the full completion of their nature. You need us to come in and give them some fertilizer and prune them properly in order for it to work. Now, the first thing to note about this relationship of art completing nature is the potential anthropocentricity of our agricultural interventions. So, I'm sure you've all read Plato's Republic, right? In book one, Socrates argues that every craft seeks what is to the advantage of its proper object, right? The shepherd fattens their sheep because they aim to bring about what is good for the sheep. I guess in this way, fattening them is completing their nature, what they couldn't do on their own. We need to, you know, spice up their food source, right? Thrasymachus defends the contrary position, that all human acts, including artistic acts, seek what is to the advantage of the agent. The shepherd fattens their sheep because doing so yields a greater profit at market, right? But regardless of whose view one adopts, insofar as the shepherd acts as the Socratic shepherd does, right, in fattening them, doing so will perfect the sheep's nature, right? Even if profit motivates you, you still produce sheep that are healthy in ways they wouldn't be on their own. There are, however, many cases where our agricultural interventions seem to be contrary to the natural goods of what we affect, where we aren't perfecting nature, but often subverting it or bringing in imperfections. Thrasymachus, Aristotle's greatest student, talks about this a lot. If you ever want to start getting interested in the philosophy of botany, Theophrastus, I think I misspoke, is the place to start. It's an incredibly sophisticated discussion of these issues, right? So he first mentions, he's like, look, the wild kinds appear to bear more fruit. For instance, the wild pear and wild olive. That is, if you just count the number of olives on the tree, it's going to be more numerous than on the trees that we produce. But the cultivated plants better fruit, having even flavors, which are sweeter and pleasanter, and in general, better blended, if one may say so. Especially true in apples. Like if you see a lot of wild, like crabapple trees, there are like hundreds of little apples, not like what you get in the store, these giant, massive things. Now, in this passage, better fruit means better tasting fruit. Better tasting to who? To us, right? It is good for plants to have fruit that tastes good, don't get me wrong, because consumption of fruit is the means by which many flowering plants disperse seed and thereby reproduce. Some animals got to eat it, goes through the digestive system, dropped with ready fertilizer at a distance far away. This is, you know, if it tasted terrible, it's no good. But we often go too far and reduce the amount of seed produced in a way that makes reproduction less successful. And Theophrastus recognizes that this is contrary to the plant's natural ends. He says, there is, to be sure, a concoction of the pericarpion, that's the edible part of the fruit. There's another of the fruit proper, and the former concoction serves to provide man with food. The latter serves the generation and perpetuation of the tree, this being what fruit and seed are for. Therefore, so in these cases, right, what's happened is the crabapple tree on its own produces enough of both kinds of tissue to reproduce well, and it has so many more seeds because there's so many more fruits, and they're good. It's going to have a better chance of reproducing, which is part of its natural end. What we've done is we've amplified one part, the part that's tasty for us, that doesn't actually help it reproduce, right? You know, me eating a crab apple and me eating a giant apple, that's just one reproductive cycle, right? That's one seed going through the process. But in making them so tasty for us, we've reduced a tree's capacity from like 1,000 little crab apples to like 100. We're actually in some way harming the plant, making it less successful in doing what it ought to do. This is very common. Look at this majestic animal, gray wolf out in nature, beautiful. We have introduced some artifice to this. Look at, have we perfected the gray wolf's nature? Has art completed what nature could not do on its own? All right, this was for us. We wanted something that we could put in a purse and take on a plane that gives us emotional support. On my way here, the people in front of me, three dogs. That is a lot of emotional support for one person. there are other pernicious ways. Turkey, like I'm not sure if you are aware, but right now we have bred turkeys such that their breasts are enormous because that's what makes you the money, right? Their breasts are so enormous that they cannot stand anymore on their legs. They are forced like their chest is on the ground, and if they walk at all, they're just kind of pushing themselves across. This isn't an animal ethics talk, but I don't think anyone would think that we are art is perfecting nature and acting in a way. This isn't like the Socratic shepherd fattening their sheep. This is doing something far worse. I don't know I have a moral to this story, but I'm pointing out that sometimes artistic interventions can complete nature, sometimes they can subvert it, but that there is an interaction in this case between art and the underlying nature of things. All right, I have 10 minutes, two more cases, but these are quick because I know others are going to be talking about them later. The next is cities. There's a certain way in which cities, like what we've been talking about in these other hard cases, are both natural and artificial. So Aristotle claims that there is a social instinct that's implanted in all men by nature. Man's a political creature, one whose nature is to live with others. And this means, in part, that we are naturally averse to isolation. We have, by virtue of being human, an impulse to live together and to enter various social relationships that are ultimately beneficial. The two most primitive natural associations are the formation of male-female couples for the sake of reproduction and the formation of relations of ruler and subject for the sake of preservation. And from these two natural relationships, families and households are formed for the sake of providing daily needs. Next, several households come together to create a village for the sake of providing things that go beyond what is needed for daily survival. And finally, these villages, the city comes to be by nature. When several villages are united into a single complete community, large enough to be nearly or quite self-sufficing, the state comes into existence, originating in the bare needs of life and continuing in existence for the sake of a good life. And therefore, if the earlier forms of society are natural, so is the state. It is the end of them, and the nature of a thing is its end. For what each thing is when fully developed, we call its nature, whether we're speaking of a man or a horse or a family. Besides, the final cause and end of a thing is the best, and to be self-sufficing is the end and the best. Hence, it is evident that the state is a creation of nature, and that man is by nature a political animal, and he who by nature, and not by mere accident, was out of the state, is either a bad man or above humanity. Now, no stage in this development, from isolated individuals to the city, is the result of deliberately chosen ends. And no stage is the result of habits developed over time. To desire survival and what is needed to secure it, to desire safety, to desire protection, to desire procreation, to desire that the pursuit of these ends occur within a broader community, and ultimately to desire not only living but flourishing, are simply part of what it is to be human. And unless circumstances or interventions frustrate or hinder these natural impulses, their ends will reliably be realized. Okay. But cities are also, in a way, artifacts. A city's constitution is its formal cause. There's Solon there, it's probably more relevant to Aristotle. Those are our constitution makers, right? A city's constitution is its formal cause. It's what makes a city the kind of city it is. Constitutional changes can affect changes in the variety of government a city realizes. Now, it's lawgivers who craft constitutions and thereby found cities. A constitution is the product of a lawgiver's artistic activity. This product is then imposed on a population. The lawgiver is, like all artificers, an external efficient cause of an artifactual form's material realization. So how do we reconcile the claim that cities come to be by nature and the claim that cities are the products of art? What comes to be by nature can be, and often can only be, perfected through art in a way analogous to what happens in the good cases of agriculture. The lawgiver produces a constitution that is a city's formal cause, but the matter in which this form is realized is not merely a plurality of individuals. For just as for other craftsmen, such as the weaver or shipbuilder, it is necessary that some material is available that is fitting for the function. For to the extent that it turns out to be better prepared, the thing that comes to be by art will necessarily also be better. And in the same way also is it necessary for the politician and the lawgiver that material is available that is suitable, being fittingly disposed. It is the associations that we enter by nature that is a suitable matter for the imposition of the constitution that is the result of the lawgiver's activity. The reason that the introduction of a formal constitution is required is that humans' natural associations on their own are insufficient to provide the conditions that would allow humans to flourish. Aristotle says, when several villages are united in a single complete community, large enough to be nearly or quite self-sufficing, the state comes into existence, originating in the bare needs of life, and continuing in existence for the sake of a good life. The communities that arise through the satisfaction of people's natural political desires suffice to guarantee survival, reproduction, the provision of basic, and sometimes luxurious goods, what Plato calls relishes, the three Ps, pastries, perfumes, and prostitutes, the luxuries people have. These communities come to be for the sake of living and can succeed and attain this natural end, but more is needed if people are to not only live, but live well. Humans are born with the capacity, but not the means, to live full human lives. The opportunity to live such a life requires the cultivation of properly human excellences, the moral and intellectual virtues, which can only take place in the context of a political community with appropriate laws. To live well, one must acquire the virtues, but none of the moral excellences arises in us by nature. It is only in the context of the imposition of just laws and the institution of wise educational regimens that virtue is inculcated. In this ways, the deficiencies of nature are what art and education seek to fill up. So the need of external artifice to perfect what exists but cannot flourish by nature is not in tension with the natural status of its citizens' associations. That is, the end that the lawgiver aims to achieve is the same end of its citizens' natural inclinations. The desire to live well is not just compatible with the natural desire to live, it's the very same inclination. The lawgiver enables citizens to realize completely the same natural end that guides them prior to the law's imposition. Though the law is an external cause, it does not hinder the nature of the citizens, but rather helps them achieve what they could not on their own. Art completes, again, what nature begins. It's interesting to note that there's at least one contrast with the way art completes nature in this political case and in the earlier agricultural cases, right? We are the sources of the law and political civilization. We create our own conditions for flourishing, right? The law is an external cause for humans qua citizens, but is internal to humans qua lawgivers. Now, this is something Aristotle thinks and Aquinas won't. He thought that human civilization has gone through endless cycles of destruction and regeneration over the eternally extended past, right? The world's been around eternally. You know, every 20,000 years, a giant flood wipes out all human civilization. And every time, it comes back, right, in precisely the way it did before. Each time the city comes to be by nature in the same predictable stages. Each time the very same crafts come to be. We are craftsmen by nature. And in a sense, the prima facie conflict between the natural and the artificial accounts of the city's unity dissolves. Our proper natural environment is artificial. All right, the last case, and this is getting above my pay grade, so I'll be very brief, is the final way in which something's nature can be completed. Aquinas says, final and perfect happiness can consist in nothing else than the vision of the divine essence. If, therefore, the human intellect, knowing the essence of some created effect, knows more of God than that he is, the perfection of that intellect does not yet reach simply the first cause, but there remains in it the natural desire to seek the cause. Wherefore, it is not yet perfectly happy. Consequently, for perfect happiness, the intellect needs to reach the very essence of the first cause. And thus it will have its perfection through union with God, as with that object in which alone man's happiness consists. Now, the provision, the gift of the beatific vision, is not entirely analogous to what I was describing before. It's not an artistic or productive act. I mean, our creation is analogous to that in many ways. But it does have, in some ways, the same structure of perfecting what nature could not on its own. All men by nature desire to know. But we are finite beings, our intellects are restricted, and the essences that we could come to know and contemplate are limited. They're pretty amazing what we can come to know. You know, I can know what a triangle is, I can know the circular motion of the heavens, I can find out the essences of all sorts of species of natural organisms. We are not capable on our own to have a grasp of God's divine essence. But in that way, we are lacking. We cannot be complete, right? Our natural desire to know is an attempt to overcome ignorance, right? To replace, you know, the first impulse to philosophy is wonder, and part of wonder is a recognition of one's ignorance, that you don't know, and the impulse to know is to fill up what one lacks and to complete oneself. And in this way, this is another example in which something external is required in order for us to actually achieve the natural desires that we have. Our natural desire to know will only be satisfied when all essences are known, but there is one in which we cannot, through our own devices, achieve this end. This is not exactly a case in which art perfects nature, but it is a case in which an external principle is required to change us in a way in order for our nature to be complete. That is all. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.